When it comes to weight loss, no two people are the same. That's why Noom builds personalized plans based on your unique psychology and biology. Take Brittany. After years of unsustainable diets, Noom helped her lose 20 pounds and keep it off.
I was definitely in a yo-yo cycle for years of just losing weight, gaining weight, and it was exhausting.
And Stephanie. She's a former D1 athlete who knew she couldn't out-train her diet, and she lost 38 pounds.
My relationship to food before Noom was never consistent.
And Evan, he can't stand salads, but he still lost 50 pounds with Noom.
I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. Even through the pickiness, Noom taught me that building better habits builds a healthier lifestyle. I'm not doing this to get to a number. I'm doing this to feel better.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom users compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hello, my name is Matt, host of the Pirate History Podcast. Pirates rank among the most mythologized and romanticized of all historical figures. It can become easy to forget that pirates were real people that had real-world concerns. If you like tales of high seas adventure, derring do, and also want to learn more about who Blackbeard supported to be king, you can learn more about all of that at the Pirate History Podcast.
Welcome to Pax Britannica. Season 3, Episode 27. Masters of the Seas. Welcome back to Pax Britannica. I'm your host, Dr. Samuel Hume. Before we begin today, we have new members of the House of Lords. Fernando Lopez Ojeda, the new King's favourite, Joanne, Countess of Darlington, and Nick, Baron Playfair. All patrons get their own premium RSS feed that lets them listen to the podcast without ads. The new Countess and the new King's favourite, the King can have more than one favourite, also get access to the bonus content. Go to patreon.com/PaxBritannica to find out more. Last week, we saw how the States Navy of the Commonwealth of England reversed their defeat to the Dutch. After the Battle of Dungeness, the Council of State and the Rump Parliament opened up the money taps, reorganised the Navy to improve its coordination, and laid the foundations of the future Royal Marines. With repairs, reinforcements, and revolutionary fervour, General at Sea Robert Blake met the Dutch Admiral Tromp off the coast of Portland. Though Blake was far from a perfect admiral, he was a very good soldier, and over the course of the day, English firepower ground the Dutch fleet down. Despite a daring nighttime escape from Tromp, the Battle of Portland was a disaster for the Netherlands. As we saw last week, the States Navy undertook some reforms in the wake of Dungeness. After Portland, more reforms were implemented. It had been a victory, but the States Navy had taken much more of a beating than it needed to, and the victory hadn't been complete. Tromp had limped away, after all. Though the Dutch fleet was not destroyed, Portland was devastating to the Dutch in a wider sense. After the Battle of Portland, the English Channel was once again closed to Dutch shipping, and once again, any ships headed to or from America, the Caribbean, Africa, Asia, or the Mediterranean now had to sail around Britain and Ireland first. Reaching Brittany via this route was more than twice as long as going through the Channel, and it was far more expensive. It took longer, so the crews needed more supplies, and they had to be paid more. The weather was also much worse, so ships suffered more, and insurance rates skyrocketed, and that was on top of the increase for wartime danger. This all increased costs, directly and indirectly, and since the main strength of the Dutch carrying trade was their cheapness, that was a problem. Those ships and merchants which could afford to sail were often too scared to. News of Portland and the dominance of the States Navy kept many Dutch ships in port, whether they were in the Netherlands or scattered across the globe. Unemployment rose dramatically because of how much the coastal Dutch provinces relied on the sea for employment. And not just for trade. A large part of people's diet was fish, mostly herring, and the vast fishing fleets which trawled the North Sea would be easy pickings for the English. In March, De Witt returned to the waves after being promised a fleet of 40 warships. Despite the promises, he only got 18. De Witt was furious, of course, but he now had a personal experience of the power of English broadsides. The best target for his sortie was the Newcastle Coal Fleet, sailing down the coast to provide for the fires and furnaces of London. Unfortunately for De Witt, the coal fleet spotted him on the horizon, and they sailed for the protection of Scarborough Castle and its powerful guns. De Witt gave up and went home, with nothing to show for his expedition. Despite the defeat of Portland, this was the Netherlands. Despite the divisions between the provinces, within the States General, between the admirals, between Orangists and Statists, the Dutch could still build ships. The Battle of Portland in February 1653 had been the worst naval defeat for the United Provinces ever. By May, their naval fleet was back up to 100 ships, and on the 5th of May, Tromp once again set sail, once again escorting a convoy, and once again eager to face the English. On the English side, the aftermath of Portland was a mixed bag. The damage from the battle was substantial, and it took nearly as long to repair the English fleet as it did for the Dutch to repair theirs. There were some improvements made. To help them fend off Dutch boarding parties, Admiral Robert Blake ordered wooden forecastles built on the smaller ships. These would provide the crews with a much better defensive position if Dutch marines managed to get aboard. This was not the only way that the States Navy adapted to Dutch tactics, but more shortly. Naval supplies from within the Commonwealth, from the American colonies, and those rare shipments from Scandinavia went right into the fleet. Impressment continued, and the net was flung even wider. Sailors were recruited, or conscripted, from across the Commonwealth, at least as far as the Isle of Man. The Newcastle coal fleet was pillaged of sailors, and newly arrived ships from the American colonies were stripped of seamen. In terms of losses, the English had suffered far fewer casualties than their enemies, but there were still hundreds of wounded, and it didn't take long for sickness to rage through the crews, especially after they reached Portsmouth. Blake and his officers petitioned the Council of State to look after the wounded and the families of the dead. The Navy's leaders were genuinely concerned about the issue, but we can't pretend that they were ignoring the practical value of generous treatment. It was already hard enough to recruit, or conscript men, for the fleet. If the government abandoned the wounded and the widowed, it would get even harder. The Rump immediately voted payments to the families of the dead and arranged pensions for the wounded. Physicians were sent to Portsmouth, where they found that the battle wounded were far from their only patients. The lead physician, Dr. Daniel Whistler, was horrified by what he found. The crews of the fleet had disembarked and been lodged wherever space could be found, and when space could be found, it was soon filled with far more men than was sanitary. Sickness was ravaging the wounded and the healthy both. He ordered the least wounded sailors back onto their ships, keeping them safe from contagion, while also freeing up space for those too sick or wounded to travel. The worst cases were removed to hospitals, set up across Portsmouth, and this included Admiral Blake. His leg, ravaged by bar shot in the battle, had become infected, and Blake had come down with a fever. He still worked as best he could from his sickbed, but in practical terms, leadership of the States Navy now fell to George Monk and Richard Dean. Portland was George Monk's first naval battle, and he had thoughts. Together with Blake and Dean, the three generals turned admirals drafted the Instructions in March 1653. Remember a few episodes ago when I described fleet tactics as more of a pub brawl than an elegant dance? This is the start, or at least a potential start, of that changing. So far in the war, the English and Dutch fleets had engaged each other in the usual way, charging at each other and then firing at the first ship in range and then proceeding along their preferred idiom. The Dutch aiming for the rigging and for boarding actions, and the English bombarding them with cannon fire until they sank or surrendered. The instructions proposed a different approach. One that utilised the strengths of the English while simultaneously denying those of the Dutch. And really, it boils down to one thing. Staying out of boarding range. Because the English guns were bigger and fired their shots further, their effective range was much higher than those of the Dutch. They also didn't prioritise boarding, so sinking an enemy ship from distance was perfectly fine with the States Navy. The instructions proposed that, at the signal of the Admiral, the entire fleet would move from their columns into a line, turning their broadsides towards the Dutch fleet. Then they'd move no closer to the Dutch and begin bombarding them with disciplined volleys of cannon fire. The smaller Dutch guns could never match the effectiveness of the large English ones at long distance, and besides, their main point was to enable Dutch boarding actions. But if the English weren't moving to melee range, then the Dutch had to run the gauntlet to close the distance, if they had the weather gauge. If they didn't have the weather gauge, then there really wasn't much they could do other than slowly tack against the wind, under fire, stand their ground, under fire, or withdraw, again, under fire. It's actually quite a straightforward tactic that put the powerful gunnery of the States Navy at its heart. Blake, Monk, and Dean were all experienced artillery commanders on land. Much like how the early stages of the Battle of Portland resembled a siege, their massive 3rd, 2nd, and 1st rates were floating artillery batteries. A series of flag signals was implemented to make such a tactic possible, and all that needed doing now was testing the instructions in battle.
We are actuaries. In a world filled with unpredictability, we use our math skills to navigate uncertainty. Actuaries make a difference in people's lives across industries and the world. Actuaries have the freedom to work anywhere. And according to U.S. News & World Report, we're the 25th top-paying career. Make an impact as a fact seeker and a truth teller. Use your math skills for good as an actuary. The world needs you.
Was the Sphinx 10,000 years old?
Were there serial killers in ancient Greece and Rome?
What were the lives of transgender, intersex, and non-binary people like in the ancient world?
We're Jen.
And Jenny.
From Ancient History Fangirl. We tell you true stories and tall tales of the ancient world. Sometimes we do it tipsy. Sometimes we have amazing guests on our show. Historians like Barry Strauss, podcasters like Liv Albert, Mike Duncan, and authors like Joanne Harris and Ben Aronovich.
We take you to the top of Hadrian's Wall to watch the Roman Empire fall at the end of the world.
We walk the catacombs beneath the Temple of the Feathered Serpent under Teotihuacan.
We walk the sacred spirals of the Nazca Lines in search of ancient secrets.
And we explore mythology from ancient cultures around the world.
Come find us at AncientHistoryFangirl.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
At the start of April, both fleets were ready to fight again. Several squadrons were combined under the command of Monk and Dean, and not counting fireships, the fleet soon numbered more than 100 warships. Back in the Thames, another fleet was being put together on the orders of Blake, still recovering from sickness. Tromp set sail around the same time and escorted a convoy to the Shetland Islands. After that, he picked up scattered Dutch ships which had sheltered in Scandinavian ports since Portland. Once back in the Netherlands, he was reinforced by Evertsen and Florisoon, and soon commanded a fleet of around 100, mostly men of war but also about half a dozen fireships and support vessels. The last few weeks had seen the two fleets miss each other, like ships in the night, ha ha. Dean and Monk had chased Tromp to the Shetlands, but missed him. They'd returned south and scoured the Dutch coast for him, but he'd been patrolling the Scandinavian coast for stragglers. Once he returned, he sat out once again looking for the English, hoping to find them in the Downs. But when he reached the Downs, the English fleet was back off the coast of the Netherlands. Tromp was eager for battle, eager to the point of frustration now that he could not find his enemy. Passing Dover, he took out his frustration by firing broadsides at the castle. This was pointless, and it cost valuable ammunition. It also announced to Monk and Dean that Tromp was at Dover. Tromp's scout ships also spotted the States Navy, and so both fleets prepared for the fight they both wanted. On the 1st of June, Monk and Dean sailed out of Sol Bay with 105 warships. Both commanders were aboard the Resolution, the powerful first rate now fully repaired. Blake, aware that battle was imminent, dragged himself out of bed. Despite a fever and apparent kidney stones, he was not going to miss a fight if he had any say in it. He led a squadron out of the Thames to join the rest of the fleet, but that will take him time. So, Monk and Dean command the fleet aboard the Resolution, leading the Red Squadron in the centre. William Penn commands the White on the right, and John Lawson leads the Blue on the left. At noon, the scout ships of the Blue, because the States Navy is using scouts now, use the new signals described in the instructions to inform the rest of the fleet that the enemy had been spotted. Holding the weather gauge, the States Navy turned towards their enemy. At about 4 p.m, Lawson, whose Blue squadron was closest to the approaching Dutch, took up position off Gavard Shoal, slowing his squadron down to allow the rest of the fleet to catch up, because the States Navy concentrates its forces now. When they formed up, they anchored for the night, confident that the Dutch, and especially Tromp, wanted a battle and would still be there in the morning. Yet another lesson learned by the English. The following morning, the sun rose on an English navy acting very differently to that which had fought at Portland 4 months earlier. They were all in one place, for one thing. As they weighed anchor and began to move, they had the weather gauge. Once they reached double cannon shot, twice the range of a cannon, totaling about 2,000 yards, from Tromp, they stopped and formed into a line. Now this was new. Then, with Lawson and the Blue at its head, the fleet sailed closer to the Dutch, who were tacking against the wind and probably wondering when the English were going to charge them. Once the fleet reached half cannon shot, about 500 yards, they stopped moving, their broadsides facing the assembled Dutch fleet, and got to work. 500 yards was nothing for the experienced gunners of the States Navy, and their heavy guns unleashed broadside after broadside at the Dutch. For the next 3 hours, ships' bells rang, cannons answered, and Dutch sailors died. The Dutch were sitting ducks. 500 yards was far further than any musket could effectively reach, so the large number of marines and sharpshooters crowding the decks and rigging of their ships could do nothing. Dutch cannons, lighter than the English, were ineffective at this range, although they could do damage, as Dean discovered to his cost. In the very first exchange of fire, one of the very few Dutch cannonballs to reach the English fleet hit him and killed him instantly. Monk was standing right by his fellow commander. Besides the emotional or spiritual trauma of his friend's instantaneous and gruesome death right in front of him, Monk was entirely unharmed. He took off his cloak, which must have been covered in Dean, to cover Dean, and had the body taken below decks as subtly as it could be. The wind shifted and allowed De Ruyter's squadron to charge part of the English line, but against this new strategy, the Dutch disable and capture tactic was not working. One Dutch ship sank, another exploded, and De Ruyter was forced to back off. In another achievement of seamanship, the English line reformed after this attack, and the bombardment continued until light faded. The following day, the Dutch woke to find that many of their ships had deserted in the night. Tromp also had to reckon with the costs of his early tantrum. Bombarding Dover Castle meant that now the fleet was short of ammunition. They probably had enough for one determined attack, but after that they'd have to withdraw, regardless of how well it went. On the English side, the Council of War felt that the previous day should have gone better. Monk decided that the enemy had been battered enough, and it was time to charge them, to scatter the fleet and win a decisive battle. When the Dutch withdrew, they were to chase them for as long as it was safe. The enemy would shelter in the dangerous shallows of the coast. One of Monk's subordinates, clearly a veteran of the Scottish occupation, described it as, quote, "The enemy will go where we cannot follow him, like the Highlanders to the mountains." In the morning of the 2nd of June, there wasn't enough wind for any action, but in the afternoon, the two fleets charged each other. The English had the weather gauge, and when Tromp couldn't seize it from them through manoeuvring, he called a withdrawal. The Dutch rearguard was always in range of English guns, and ship after ship was hulled and sunk. Discipline held, though, at least until a new arrival was spotted on the horizon, heading right for the port side of the Dutch formation. Admiral Blake's squadron had finally arrived, drawn by scouts and the sound of gunfire. News that it was Blake spread through both fleets like wildfire, to cheers from the English and panic from the Dutch. The withdrawal became a rout. Many captains cutting each other off in their desperation to get away, many more getting tangled and surrendering to the English. By nightfall, the remains of the Dutch fleet was safe in a Dutch estuary. 8 ships had been sunk, another 11 had been captured, and 8 more were missing. All of Tromp's fireships had been wasted, set alight but hitting nothing. Many of those ships still sailing were only just. Even the Brederode was losing its battle with the water, its crews desperately pumping the hull until the great ship could be deliberately beached for repairs. The Dutch fleet was in a very bad way, and even De Witt couldn't mince his words when he addressed the States General after the defeat of the Gavard, quote, "Why should I keep my silence longer? What use is it to equivocate, standing here before my sovereigns? I can and must say that the English are at present masters of both us and the seas." In the aftermath of the Battle of the Gavard, the English fleet anchored off the Dutch coast, seizing prizes here and there as the people of the Netherlands watched from the beaches and dikes. Despite the propaganda of the States General, which claimed that the battle wasn't that bad and the English had lost many ships, the proof of the lie was sitting off the shore. The Netherlands was now blockaded, and some of the busiest ports in Europe, in the world, were closed. The economic damage I covered earlier was now magnified tenfold. The Dutch, wealthy or poor, were exhausted by this war. Many merchants were financially ruined, sailors were out of work, and the price of food was skyrocketing from the loss of the herring supply. But the States General could not consider peace under these conditions. With a fleet blockading the Netherlands, it would be an outright defeat, and there were many statists who feared that in that circumstance, an Orangist reaction would surely take place. Though an envoy was sent to London to negotiate, preparations for another battle, which would clear the English blockade, were underway. Tromp, as resolute as ever, pushed the shipwrights hard. The heavy ships he'd requested the previous year were still being built, and although not exactly how he originally wanted them, anything was better than nothing. The Dutch rapidly rebuilt their fleet, but they had 2 major problems. The first was a lack of guns. The heavy guns needed to counter this new English strategy of rudely staying away from their boarding parties had to be imported, and the best way to transport heavy iron cannons was by sea, so these shipments were often captured and added to the English arsenal. The second was geography, which I mentioned in the earlier episodes of the series. The Dutch fleet was split in 2, the Scheldt estuary in the south and the Helder in the north. In between the 2 halves of the fleet was the English. Meanwhile, it wasn't all sunshine and roses for the English. The blockade was taking a toll. Blockading, despite the success Blake had achieved over Portugal, was still a rough science, and the logistics hadn't all been worked out yet. Supplies were running low, and sickness was spreading among the crew. Soon, the blockade would be ineffective, because there'd not be enough sailors to man the ships. But if they withdrew back to England to restock, repair, and swap out the sick for the healthy, then the Dutch would immediately bounce back. What followed was a very cunning trick. The large ships sailed away to Sole Bay for what they needed, and smaller 5th and 6th rates stayed behind, keeping up the watch and sailing back and forth from port to estuary. Their job was to be seen, and to use their flags to signal out to sea. To Dutch onlookers, it appeared that these ships were just the only visible part of the blockade, which was otherwise fully active, ready to swoop in when signalled. The seamanship, or perhaps the acting, of these frigates prevented Tromp from seeing through the ruse, and by the end of July, the rest of the fleet was back on station. Blake had not come back with Monk. His kidney stones were so bad he thought he was dying. He didn't die, but his recovery took him out for the rest of the war. Monk was now in sole command. At the start of August, Tromp believed he was ready. His fleet was repaired and restocked, and from his base in the Scheldt, he sent word to De Witt in the Helder to prepare to sail. A complicated arrangement was made, which relied on skilled seamanship and an understanding of each other's minds. They had to leave when the weather allowed them to leave, then avoid the English fleet and link up at sea without any way of communicating after leaving port. If they didn't, The larger English fleet would destroy them piece by piece. But if they could, they had a chance to win a great victory. When Monk received word that De Witt was preparing to leave port, he sailed north to enforce the blockade. A few days later, Tromp's fleet was spotted coming from the south. He'd weighed anchor once he learned of De Witt and Monk's movements and was now bearing down on the English. Monk lifted the blockade and prepared to engage Tromp, holding the weather gauge, and Tromp fell back. But this allowed De Witt to act as well, and he soon sailed out of port, chasing Monk, who was chasing Tromp. Monk managed to catch up to Tromp, and heavy fighting broke out, and De Witt was still some distance away when night fell. Neither fleet anchored for the night. The English let the wind slowly push them south as they made their repairs and expected the Dutch to do the same. Instead, Tromp once again showed his skill. In the dark of night, he tacked against the wind and got around the north of the English fleet, and in the morning, the English discovered that Tromp wasn't where they expected. He was slightly behind them, and it didn't take long for De Witt to reach his admiral. Tromp and De Witt had done it. The two fleets had become one. One with a slight numbers advantage, but they couldn't make much of it. The weather that day, as always the weather, was terrible, and both fleets were so close to land that they were more focused on avoiding getting wrecked and keeping themselves together than fighting. The following day, the two fleets prepared to fight. With the wind gauge, Tromp formed up into a line abreast, a row, and sailed right at Monk. Monk brought out the new instructions, and formed his fleet into a line ahead, a column. And he used a tactic similar to one which Nelson would use at Trafalgar. He tacked against the wind and dove right through the Dutch formation. With the great ship Resolution at the column's head, the heavy guns of the States Navy fired down the Dutch line on both sides as they pierced it. Monk planned to wheel about, seizing the weather gauge and bombarding Tromp. But Tromp saw this move coming, and he turned quickly, and what followed was a deadly tacking race. Each time the ships cut diagonally against the wind, and their port or starboard faced the enemy, they fired their broadsides. This contest carried on for hours, and as it happened in every battle of the war, English gunnery was much more effective than the Dutch. More and more Dutch ships were disabled at each pass, more sank, more surrendered. In another sign of how deeply reform had embedded itself into the States Navy, those surrendered ships were not pounced on by opportunistic captains looking for a prize. The instructions were clear. Once in formation, it could not be broken. Four times the fleets crossed each other before the firepower of the States Navy cracked Dutch resolve. The squadrons scattered, with many ships from Tromp, Florisoon, and De Witt's commands fleeing downwind. Evertsen and De Ruyter sailed east, with De Ruyter's ship being towed. De Witt attempted to call the ships back, ever ready to continue a fight, but reality set in. The day was lost, and he did what he could to gather up a rearguard to prevent a complete rout. In the first of those crossings, an English marksman fired his musket and hit Tromp in the chest. He was carried below by his men, and as his officers gathered around, the beloved admiral died. His last words were reportedly, "I have run my course. Have good courage." The death of Daddy Tromp was kept from the rest of the fleet until after the battle, for fear of what it would do to morale. He would be buried in a state funeral with all the pomp and ceremony of a national hero. The Battle of Scheveningen was a tactical defeat for Tromp. His fleet was scattered, and many ships and sailors were lost, perhaps 3,000 dead, wounded, or captured, with at least 20 ships sunk and many more taken as prizes. Also, he was killed. But his final battle had broken the blockade. The States Navy needed to sit in port for some time afterwards, for repairs and resupply, and this gave his countrymen a chance to recover, economically and militarily. The Anglo-Dutch War was not yet over, but we will leave it here for now. Skirmishes and raids would continue, but the story of it ends like all wars end, around the negotiating table, as the politicians work out exactly what all the fighting and death was for. But the politicians who led the Commonwealth into war would not be the same as those who decided the peace. because throughout the time period covered in this episode, back on land, there were some very dramatic political events taking place. We didn't touch on them, because neither did our subjects. They had a war to fight. But in London, the revolution had entered its next stage. Patience with the rump parliament had run out, and once again, the new model army under Oliver Cromwell will make its mark on history, as the last relic of the old English constitution is swept away at the end of a gun. Thank you to my House of Lords, including the King's favourite Mike Sanders, the Duke of Bracewell, David Braswell, the Marquess of Winchester, Christian Sebaste, and the Earl of Lindsay, Samuel Manca. Go to patreon.com/PaxBritannica to join their ranks and listen to the podcast without ads. If you enjoy the podcast, please recommend it to a friend or consider leaving a review. For other great podcasts on the Airwave Network, such as History That Doesn't Suck, check out airwavemedia.com. Thank you to Sounds Like an Earful for the interval music in today's episode, to my entire House of Lords, and to you for listening.
My name is Greg Jackson. I'm a historian, professor, and the creator of History That Doesn't Suck, a podcast that provides a complete overview of U.S. history through storytelling, yet keeps the rigor you'd expect in a university class. Starting with 22-year-old George Washington in his first battle, join me for a chronological telling of the United States' story, its unlikely revolution, fractious civil war, tenacious inventors, brave reformers, and more. With more than 100 episodes, you can already binge listen your way through the progressive era. Find History That Doesn't Suck wherever you get your podcasts.